Hello, wine enthusiasts. Thanks for joining me for today's travels on the Wine Road.
Part of the pleasure that wine can bring to the senses, to the sense of taste, to the perception of form in a wine, that sense of completeness can give the pleasure that I want the human being to be experiencing.
On today's podcast, a man whose work stands in the Smithsonian Institution next to George Washington's uniform and sword, the Spirit of St. Louis, Neil Armstrong's spacesuit, Chuck Berry's Gibson guitar, Apple's Macintosh computer, and 96 other items that represent the history of America. That work is a bottle of his 1973 Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon, one of the wines that surprised the French and brought global attention to the California wine industry in 1976. Warren Winiarski is an icon. At 90 years old, he doesn't make wine anymore, having sold Stag's Leap Wine Cellars in 2007, but continues wine growing and selling grapes to Stag's Leap Wine Cellars from his Arcadia Vineyard in Coombsville in southeast Napa Valley. I had the great and humbling opportunity to spend over 2 hours with this engaging, charming man. I recorded him in his car, among the vines, and in his on-site trailer. You'll hear the differences in the audio as we made our way through the interviews. What brought us together was an email from Jessica Nussbaum, the Director of Communications and Marketing at the University of California at Davis. The Warren Winiarski Family Foundation had just donated $3.3 million to the school's library to preserve and increase access to the library's collection of work from some of the world's most prominent wine writers, including Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. Interestingly, Warren sees wine writers not so much as information for consumers, more importantly, as inspiration for winemakers and those in the industry to continue to challenge themselves.
We have not explored all the places where great wine, beautiful wines can be made. Mm-hmm. And so there are other places which will come about, and maybe the California experience would be significant for them to learn how to organize themselves.
Yeah, you seem to appreciate the fact that wine writers help draw attention to what's going on in the wine industry and even inspire winemakers.
Mm-hmm. They do, because they provide some of the vocabulary that a winemaker instinctively might be working without having the vocabulary to generate a self-description of what's going on when they're working with grapes, vines, and wine. So that's useful to have that, beneficial to have that access to that, and wine writers were important in that development.
There are some people who don't think wine writers are that important, but even Jancis Robinson, I think, is humble about her contribution to the industry, but certainly she and Hugh Johnson have contributed quite a bit over the years.
Yeah. And self-understanding is important, and they contribute to that. It's been very helpful in Colorado, for example, to have the benefit of these tastings where you pass on the judgment of the judges, helps them formulate what they need to do to make the wines better.
Gives them some fodder to consider and what they're doing. And certainly the wine writers inspire the consumer, too.
Yes. Also to articulate. Wine is talking. Wine is, it's the beverage that people pause and try to explain. Mm-hmm. The nuance, what they're experiencing. And so that's useful to have.
Well, as a journalist myself, I think anyone whose work will benefit from your thoughtful gift will certainly be incredibly honored.
Well, thank you. I hope they find the right person. They're in the process now of trying to find the right person to do this. And it will go on because this is a permanent endowment.
And that will include preservation of the writer's contributions as well as increasing the collection there at the library, too.
Yes, my understanding.
Well, certainly time and time again, you've offered your own contribution to the wine industry. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, you mean the Paris tasting in particular?
Well, there are so many other things I've known about and discovered as well.
I had the good fortune the good luck to have good teachers and who were willing to share with me their thoughts, their vision, and their ways, starting from the very first, Lee Stewart.
Let me interject here. Lee Stewart founded the original Chateau Souverain back in 1944. His name is not one you hear too often, but he is considered as much of a contributor to the Northern California wine industry as Andre Chelischev, Maynard Amerine, and Louis M. Martini. Interestingly, Lee hired Mike Gergich as his first winemaker, and it was Mike's first head winemaking job. Mike later went to Chateau Montelena, whose Chardonnay also outscored the French wines in 1976. Apparently, Lee was an outstanding educator, as Warren confirms.
Lee Stewart could not have been better, the detail orientation, and to keep in mind that the small things are important. No detail is unworthy of attention. Mm-hmm. All, no matter how small, are important to have your attention because it's there frequently, and the timing is a matter. And Lee Stewart was part of that. Robert Mondavi was part of that. Dr. Ivensey, in his own way, was part of that. And so these habits and ways of approaching the material that you're working with and attuning your spirit to what's going on in the vine and what's going on in the wine at later is very important because the wine is a developing thing from the moment you change that juice. It's developing and has its own way, and you're part of the process of guiding that transformation.
Mm-hmm. That's how you see yourself, as being more of a, just a guide, helping it find its way, in a sense, and find its best way.
Well, you're looking to say, what do I have to do or not do to let this become the best it can be.
To interject again, later on, Warren wanted to expound on his goal as a winemaker, thinking that what he just said there wasn't expressive enough about his process. So he wanted me to include this description.
So that's an overview. What kind of feeling do I want humans to have when they taste this wine, if it has the capacity? So I'm looking for its capacity to achieve that goal. As a generality, I want it to be as complete an experience for the taster that they have a sense of completeness. And the reason for that is that we ourselves, as human beings, lack completeness.
In so many facets or just...
I mean, obviously, we live in cities, we live together with other human beings. We're not complete by ourselves. We have friends, we have lovers, we have family. All of these things are different forms of association for the individual human being, which itself is not complete. It lacks completeness. Hmm. That part of the pleasure that wine can bring to the senses, to the sense of taste, to the perception of form in a wine as structure, that sense of completeness can give the pleasure that I want to the human being who tastes it to be experiencing.
That was just the beginning of a long and deep conversation about the perception and feeling he wanted those who consumed his wine to experience, that completeness. He took me on a 20-minute description that only a mathematician, architect, or designer, or one who studied those vocations may understand, about the geometric golden rectangle. I'll share some more of that later in the podcast. It's fascinating. Now, back to the previous conversation, we were just about to get into a pivotal point in his career.
There was that one day you were tasting with Nathan Fay, and you tasted something unique over there at his vineyard in the Stag's Leap area that
his
made you realize
wine.
It was a homemade wine. Huh?
Yeah, it was a homemade wine, and he was a good winemaker in his way, and that was an inspiration. I mean, it revealed itself has something extraordinary in its potential. Everything that I would like to have to work with.
And you felt confident enough at the time that you thought,
I can do this.
You can do this. And so you got some investors together and you built a winery, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
So your first vintage was 72, but the first wine that came out of Stag's Leap Wine Cellars was the 73 vintage. And that's the one that was submitted to the Paris tasting.
Yes. 72 was not made at that winery. Mm-hmm. 73 was. That was the first wine made at the winery. And that went to Paris.
But astounding
and
that.
And the Prune Orchard also. The next to Nathan Fay's vineyard, the Prune Orchard, had been potentially a Paris tasting wine for all of its life before that, growing prunes. The moral of that story, never underestimate what you might find in a prune orchard if you put your mind to it.
The way he looks at winemaking and nature and life is just enchanting, mind-blowing at times. In a moment, you'll hear Warren mention his father. He was a home winemaker in Chicago, yet being around his father's hobby was not necessarily what inspired Warren to become a winemaker himself. At this point in the conversation, I asked him to describe to me what it was like when he found out that his Cabernet Sauvignon outscored the French Bordeaux's in the Paris tasting of 1976.
Well, it was really, that moment was a non-event for me.
Oh, really? Initially, right?
Because when Dorothy Chelyshev had called, I should add in that group of people who were good teachers for me, Andre, who I had had as a consultant, his wife called, and they had just returned from Paris. They had heard about it the day before. She called Barbara. I was in Chicago.
Barbara's your wife?
Yeah. Dorothy called and let her know, and then Barbara called me. Now, just think about that. I'm in Chicago where I first put my ear to the barrel of my father's wine. They're both dead now. And I was settling up the details of the estate. And she said, you remember Stephen Spurrier? And I said, yeah, I remember Steve. He said he had a tasting in Paris. I said, yes. And she said, and we won the tasting. We came in first. I said, that's nice.
You didn't understand the impact of that,
no,
did you?
I didn't understand what the other wines were in the tasting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. It wasn't set up as a beauty contest. In a beauty contest, you have all the wines before you. And then you go and make your judgment of all the wines. In this, there was only one glass filled at any time. They were sequentially tasted, not simultaneously.
Oh, I see.
I didn't know which were the other wines in the tasting. Mm-hmm. So with these unknowns, you might say, it's nice to win a tasting any place when you're starting a winery.
Yeah.
It could be in Timbuktu and you win a tasting, not in Paris. And then when the following day, when I discovered which were the wines and who were the judges, all French judges, I didn't know that when I got the first information. So it grew exponentially, you might say. It was a wonderful outcome.
And they've done it many times since then, and the American wines are still hanging in there, and they defeated the French for a number of subsequent tastings. Mm-hmm. At one point, they did lose, and Stephen Spurrier said that's when the Americans realized that they were resting on their laurels. That was not too long ago. That just happened recently.
That's why you need to keep thinking about what you're doing and not simply become routine.
Well, as you said earlier, you're always learning.
Yeah.
You have to apply.
Trying to.
A bottle of that 73 Stag's Leap Wine Cellars is in the Smithsonian now, isn't it?
It is.
That just shows the how important that was to the American culture.
It was part of that 101 Objects issue of the magazine. And then later, Richard Curran put it in this book, 101 Objects That Made America. Not documents, not speeches, but objects. Mm-hmm. So Lewis and Clark's compass, Spirit of St. Louis, Neil Armstrong's spaceship, they all opened up new horizons.
Mm-hmm. You must be proud to be one of those people.
I am.
That still drive you today?
I'm sort of segregated from winemaking, but I'm trying to make the best grapes I can.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated that this whole thing started. You were in college studying political philosophy, and it was a trip to Italy that really turned that switch on in your head, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So the concept of wine as an accompaniment for food didn't really develop until Italy. Mm-hmm. And then made a wonderful companion for food. So it was not just a ceremonial beverage for holidays, which it had been before as I was growing up.
It was so impactful for you, though. You changed the course of your direction, and wasn't long after, you were already planning on becoming a winemaker, huh?
Yes. You know, I returned from the graduate studies that I was doing and settled into academic life until one day a friend brought a wine from the East Coast, and we had it with lunch, the three of us, my wife and our mutual friend from college. And then everything came back about Italy and about daily beverage. I'd lost the habit.
Oh, okay.
Until that afternoon, and then it all came back. And so the need to become a part of that grew slowly, because it was just wine and not having to make it or wanting to make it, but to enjoy it. And I went to stores and haunted the stores, talked to salespeople, talked to people who knew about wine, learned more about it, read about it, and gradually the sense that I wanted to become part of the vine's life more directly through learning how to make it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump from this part back to when I first met him in his vineyard. He had me get in his car so he could drive me around and show me the property and talk about his past. As he started to do so, I decided I needed to record this. I missed the first part, but I had him back up and start over. This is an interesting story about how he first tried to get into the wine business. Then I'll come back to pick up where we left off in this current conversation.
Okay, where were we? Martin Ray.
When you started?
When I started. I tried to get a job with Martin Ray.
Yeah.
The old Martin Ray was in Santa Clara Valley.
Okay.
In the mountains.
Uh-huh.
And his wines were a beacon light for me.
Oh.
Really beautiful.
When you first moved here?
Before I moved here, I would try to get a job with Martin Ray.
Okay.
Do you remember a writer named John Strom? He was the one who wrote about Martin Ray's wines. And I wrote to Martin Ray and I asked whether I could get a job with him as an apprentice to learn how he made wine.
Yeah, because prior to that, you didn't have any knowledge of winemaking, did you? Other than what your father did, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
You were turned down.
No commercial experience, yeah. Whatever. And I went down there and didn't quite work out. He was a very self-involved person. He made these great wines, but there was so much ego, so much self-centered quality in him. And then we'd have to live on the side of the mountain up there. And I had a family by that time. And so that wouldn't have worked out. He saw that before I did.
No.
He thought I was too independent also.
Uh-huh.
So two guys of the same kind.
Right. Two egos.
Yeah. But I still love his wines.
Did you find the Martin Ray wine while you were doing that research in the liquor stores? Is that how you discovered that wine?
No, I heard about Martin Ray. It was one of the readings that I had done, mm-hmm. this John Storm book. And that way of life seemed very attractive, living on the mountaintop, making these great wines. And so I wrote then to Martin.
Wow. It was kind of gutsy at the time. The industry here was still kind of in its infancy at that point.
It was, yeah.
So this was about, well, 63, 64, and you moved out here in 64.
Yes, I moved 64. We moved to California, to the Napa Valley.
I love the idea that he was so taken by Martin Ray's wines, he just wrote him a letter and said, I'd like to come work with you. From winemaking to wine growing and philanthropic endeavors, he has contributed quite a bit to the industry. And not just in California, but in many states in the U.S. Another major contribution Warren was involved in was the Napa Valley Agricultural Preservation Act in 1968.
Yeah, the Ag Preserve.
Yeah. How did you have the foresight to consider limiting the growth and expansion?
Well, a number of us thought if I was on this committee, Jack Davies was the chairman, and Chuck Harpy was on that committee, Louis Martini, and we all thought that the way Louis Martini and Carpi were old-timers, but they had the view that unless we found some way to protect agriculture, protect grape growing, we would be overrun by the development we would become another Santa Clara. I had actually seen that in the Santa Clara Valley when I was trying to get a job with Martin Ray.
Okay.
I saw how the orchards had gone so quickly.
And Silicon Valley had the same thing happen down there.
Exactly.
That could be a very fruitful growing region.
That could be. They could be growing beautiful fruit down there.
Yeah. Instead of all this technology that's growing out of there.
It went a different direction. Yeah, it went a different direction. So we realized that unless we put some protections in place, the development would come.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that sure worked well, because when you drive into the valley and you see that big sea of green, we have you and Louis and the other gentlemen to thank for that.
Yeah. Well, there were others. I mean, we got it was political, getting support within the community as well, getting support of the supervisors, 5 votes.
And it's continued, too, because there have been other votes and more expansion into the regions that are covered now. So I think it went from, 23,000 acres to 38,000?
It's over 40,000.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, just ever-changing, ever-growing.
Yeah. The total number of acres, I'm not sure all of them are in the Ag Preserve. The Ag Preserve is only, it's a limited zone in the valley floor. The hillside, this would not be Ag Preserve. This is AW zone here.
But
the Ag Preserve is that down the central part of the valley, the valley floor.
And we have the existence of that beautiful expanse of vineyards, trees, and agricultural land in Napa Valley, thanks to Warren and those he mentioned. This year, 2018, the 50th anniversary of the Agricultural Preservation Act of 1968 was celebrated. As I mentioned earlier, Warren's Arcadia Vineyard is in Coombsville, which is on the southeastern end of Napa Valley, within the path of last year's Atlas Fire. In many cases, as you may have heard, the area's vineyards served as a blockade suppressing the fire's advancement. Warren's vineyards were not really affected, but it did swoop down from the hills and burned his barn and office and a home he had. As we drove through the vineyard, he pointed out another structure he lost.
Yeah, the fire came. We bought a house here. We bought the land with a house. The house burned.
Up there, too.
Yeah, even though the fire didn't come down here, the embers did. And
this is quite a distance, which people listening don't understand, that the other house and barn that you showed me was, half a mile from here? This one was over here up on the hill, and the embers carried all the way over here.
Maybe a third of a mile.
Wow, yeah, that was the crazy thing about that fire, is the embers just carried such distances.
And it had a tile roof. It had a Spanish tile roof, so impermeable. But if the house is wooden and it gets next to the house and burns the house, the roof comes down. It just burns the house first, and then the roof comes down afterwards.
I was sent a photo of Warren standing over the burned remains of the buildings he lost that I'll have on my website soon along with this interview. He just had the floor of his barn poured recently, so it's been slow going to rebuild over there. As we drove through the vineyard, he told me about the unique soil and geological history of the property on which his vineyard sits.
The diatomaceous earth subsoil gives it a unique quality.
It was a freshwater lake.
Freshwater lake. A long time ago. Probably wasn't over here. But the beaches were probably surrounding where the foothills come down.
Yeah.
There probably were the beaches, but someplace in here there was an old geological freshwater lake. And so all that diatomaceous earth that's under most of this vineyard, except for the volcanic soils on the other side, we can take a look at those, were underlain by diatomaceous earth.
So very silica, nutritious soil, I imagine.
Undernourished for most things. There's a little bit of a problem about the magnesium-calcium relationship. But we can deal with that in a foliar application, so we have a better balance. But they form, those soils tend to make a Chardonnay that's very peary in its aroma and light.
Does it stay a little bit cooler here?
It is. It's just about the same as Carneros, actually.
Okay. You're further south, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, well, we have this shaft, open shaft to the bay through Carneros. Through this whole Coombsville area has an opening to the bay, mm-hmm. Carneros microclimate.
How many acres do you have here?
84. Under plant.
His Arcadia vineyard is one of the few where you see Chardonnay growing just across the dirt road from the Cabernet Sauvignon. The location of the vineyard is in a beautiful corner of Napa Valley, nestled up against the foothills of the Vaca mountain range. Earlier in the podcast, you heard a little bit about Warren's experience before he built and gained international acclaim with Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. Now we're going to delve a little bit deeper into Warren's history. As you heard, his career started as an apprentice with Lee Stewart at Chateau Souverain.
You must have learned a lot because just 2 years later, Robert Mondavi hired you to be his first winemaker. I mean, how did you get that so quickly?
Well, Stewart had a good reputation, orientation with quality. And I think that's what it was, Mondavi and Ivan Schock and Fred Holmes. I interviewed with all of them.
Did you know Robert when he was still at Krug before he decided to leave the family and start his own?
No.
And then you only stayed there for 2 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, because Michael had come back, so the structure was in place, family structure was in place. And then came along this dentist from, had a vision also, another visionary, about bringing vinifera to Colorado.
Yeah.
That was exciting.
Did you? Yeah, you're intrigued by that?
Yeah.
Well, from what I understand, you more or less kickstarted the wine industry in Colorado.
Well, it was my enthusiasm and the doctor's financial capability, as well as his enthusiasm, had an effect. People remember this is a time when the food aspect of American life became very important, and the wine with it.
Oh, okay. This is 1968?
68, yeah.
You didn't, what was the name of the vineyard? Invincy or?
Ivancy.
You didn't go live there, though. You were just working here. You got the grapes and the juice, and you shipped it out to him?
Yeah, I'd ship it out there, and then I'd get on a plane and fly to Denver and be there when the grapes arrived. And eventually we got people interested in the Grand Junction area, and they began planting their own.
Right.
Peaches, you know, grow in that Palisades area, Grand Junction. They can grow peaches.
So that was an indication.
That was a sign.
Yeah.
Yeah. that we had enough heat and that fall frosts and spring frosts were not so excessive that we couldn't grow grapes.
After founding Stags Leap Wine Cellars in 1972, Warren's primary vineyard was the SLV, which of course stands for Stags Leap Vineyards. That served him well for many years and continues to do so for the winery. The highly revered Cask 23 comes from that vineyard. Next to what became SLV was the Fay Vineyard, which, as you heard earlier, impressed Warren so much he was inspired to buy that property, pulled out the prune orchard, planted grapes, and named it Stags Leap Vineyards. Eventually, he had the chance to purchase the Fay Vineyard, which he did in 1986. But just prior, he learned there was a major problem with that vineyard. His pal Danny Schuster, who had experience in New Zealand and Australia, helped him discover the issue.
In the process of buying the Fay Vineyard at that time, hadn't completed the process. And I knew that Nathan had made beautiful wines early, and then the wines turned out to be less beautiful for some reason. And I couldn't tell why. Maybe because lots of development had taken place, the microclimate changed, so I was wondering, I made a mistake in getting into this, buying the Fay Vineyard, and I didn't know what happened to the wine. And it was 15 minutes in the car with Danny that I knew exactly what it was.
Really? What was it?
It was the vines had acquired a different pattern of growth in the period of time that Nathan, they had gotten into what I call the death spiral by having more leaves. More leaves means more photosynthetic energy returned to the plant. That means next year there'll be more energy to be expressed. It will be expressed by making more leaves because it can only make two clusters. Mm-hmm. But it can make an infinite number of leaves if left to its own devices. More leaves means more energy, photosynthetic energy, returned to the plant.
And taking away from the process of the grapes.
Taking away, making less fruit.
And that
Are you familiar with that pattern?
I have heard about that.
Yeah.
And that occurred within, I mean, it most likely started years before, but in that 15 years that you...
Well, it was more than that for Nathan. So it happened maybe over a 10-year period, and the fruit was poor afterwards. So you couldn't make the beautiful wines that he made in the beginning.
So you just have to replant? Is that how you get around it?
Yeah. Once you get past a certain point, there's no returning it.
Yeah.
But Danny caught it, and he was able to, I hired him as a consultant then, and he came out and he helped us. And we left lots of extra canes out there and then cut the canes off so that the vines expressed what we call a kicker cane. We let lots of kicker canes. So eventually the roots got the idea that there wasn't going to be a big plant and they didn't prepare for a big plant. So
you were able to correct that problem then?
We were able to correct it. At Stags Leap Vineyard.
Okay, yeah.
The first vineyard.
The SLV.
Yeah, because it had not been in that cycle so long as it was at Fay.
But Fay was just a losing battle.
Fay means replant, which I did.
Warren, it's been a real pleasure to finally sit down with you and get to know you. And I thank you so much for driving me around and talking to me like you did.
Thank you. And get in that part about Danny Schuster, because he was another great teacher.
Right.
And he had a vineyard in New Zealand, and he lost that vineyard through circumstances. But he's still consulting with the Antonoris in Italy and with some French vineyards as well.
The Antonoris are the one that bought Stags Leap Wine Cellars, weren't they?
They were partners. Yeah, it was a joint venture.
And what did you sell, 2007?
2007, yeah.
One more accomplishment we should mention is the fact that you and Barbara have been married for, this is your 60th anniversary year, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Well, congratulations for that. That's a major accomplishment as well.
yes, it's very nice to look back over that period of time.
She must be very proud as well. Did she enjoy the lifestyle you guys created for yourself here?
She did, yes.
I sure hope you're enjoying this interview with Warren Winiarski. This is the point where I had to wrap up my radio show because of time restraints. But as I mentioned, he and I were together for over 2 hours, and I have plenty of audio. As promised earlier, I want to share with you Warren's appreciation of Mother Nature's grand design. So once again, we're going to enter the fascinating mind of Warren Winiarski. And here is his explanation of the golden rectangle. In geometry, the golden rectangle is a rectangle whose side lengths are in the golden ratio, which is the Greek phi, or phi, 1.618. Here he is explaining how that concept inspired his winemaking.
Now the question is, how many winemakers put this much thought into it?
Look to the balance. Well, go back to what I started in the beginning. What is the state of soul that you want to occur in one who drinks your wine and thinks it fine, beautiful, responsive to some need in you?
Well, balance is the key.
Completeness. But in order to be complete, you have to have difference, to harmonize different elements. The square is complete in a certain way, but it doesn't give you the same satisfaction. The square is same. You want to take same and other and put it together to a new kind of same. And that balance between difference is only one point on a line. There's only one way to divide the line. And that line is the life of the grapes is undergoing in becoming wine. So where is that point that you want to start things or stop things in order to get that balance between those different elements, the soft, the hard?
That's why when it comes down to harvest, a day or two in the wrong direction, day early, day late, can make a big difference. Huh?
Well, they say it's a little plateau. I'm not sure of the plateau, because if it is a plateau, it gets there, and then how long does it stay there? I'd rather think of it as one point exactly, but it is probably...
You're shooting for the center of that plateau, the center period.
No, because then that would give me a square. I have different elements in the vineyard. I have the intense, fiery elements in Stag's Leap Vineyard. It had those elements on soils that were born in fire.
Right.
The volcanic soils. Uh-huh. They have those soils down below that were conveyed with water. Those tend to be the soft elements. In the middle is a kind of mixture. So I have to relate the opposites, that fiery element and the water element, which are enemies, naturally, and find a way to relate them to something in the middle, so they can form this harmony of unity.
And that was your task year in, year out. Did you blend the lower part of the vineyard with the upper a certain way?
I kept that formula in mind to give you a rectangle and not a square.
Did the middle part, was it a challenge to work with that middle part in as well, or did that help it actually?
And since that's a mixture, that's the one you have to kind of think about. How is the upper part related to that? I welcome the opportunity to work with differences because I wanted to unite opposites.
No wonder his SLV, Cask 23, and Fay Vineyard wines are still some of the most revered wines ever made in Napa Valley. Knowing that my time was coming to an end with Warren, I decided to share this with him.
Tell me what you think about my thought about wine. I think of the grape as the body, like a human body. Then when it goes through crush, maceration, the juice is the soul of the grape. And then the soul is what is in the bottle. And then the soul continues to evolve for quite a while if it's made a certain way. And then finally that soul just eventually fades. But I think of a great wine as a great soul of a body. That
I do. I believe it. I describe it a little bit differently, but everything you said, I agree with. It's good.
I'll take that.
Thank you for sticking around through this longer podcast.
You can find my past interviews at onthewineroad.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at JD Wineroad and on Facebook at On the Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis. I'll catch you next time.